Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and I'm reading today from the story of John G. Payton, the missionary to the South Sea Island Cannibals, in islands formerly known as the New Hebrides, now the nation of Vanuatu. We're on chapter 63. It's called Traditions and Customs. What a suggestive tradition of the fall it came to me in one of those early days on Aniwa. Upon our leaving the hut and removing to our new house, it was seized upon by Tupa for his sleeping place, though still continuing to be used by the natives as clubhouse, court of law, and so on. One morning at daylight, this Tupa came running to us in great excitement, wielding his club furiously and crying, "Missy, I have killed the Tebil. I have killed Tiapolo. He came to catch me last night. I raised all the people, and we fought him around the house with our clubs. At daybreak, he came out, and I killed him dead. We will have no more bad conduct or trouble now. Tiapolo is dead." I said, "What nonsense. Tiapolo is a spirit and cannot be seen." But in mad excitement, he persisted that he had killed him. And at Mrs. Payton's advice, I went with the man, and he led me to a great sacred rock of coral near our old hut, over which hung the dead body of a huge and beautiful sea serpent, and exclaimed, "There he lies. Truly, I killed him." I protested, "That is not the devil. It is only the body of a serpent." The man quickly answered, "Well, but it is all the game. He is Tiapolo. He makes us bad and causes all our troubles." Following up this hint by many inquiries, then and afterwards, I found that they clearly associated man's troubles and sufferings somehow with the serpent. They worshipped the serpent as a spirit of evil, under the name of Machikchiki, that is to say, they lived in abject terror of his influence, and all their worship was directed towards propitiating his rage against man. Their story of creation, at least of the origin of their own Aniwa and the adjacent islands, is much more an outcome of the unaided native mind. They say that Machikchiki fished up these lands out of the sea, and they show the deep print of his foot on the coral rocks opposite each island, whereon he stood as he strained and lifted them up above the waters. He then threw his great fishing line round Fortuna, 36 miles distant, to draw it close to Aniwa and make them one land. But as he pulled, the line broke, and he fell, where his mark may still be seen upon the rock. And so the islands remain separated unto this day. Machikchiki placed men and women on Aniwa. On the southern end of the island, there was a beautiful spring and a freshwater river with rich land all around for plantations. But the people would not do what Machikchiki wanted them, so he got angry and split off the richer part of Aniwa with the spring and river and sailed with them across to Anitian, leaving them where Dr. English has since built his beautiful mission station. To this day, the river there is called the Water of Aniwa by the inhabitants of both lands, and it is the ambition of all Aniwans to visit Anitium and drink of that spring and river as they sign to each other, "Alas, for the waters of Aniwa." Their picture of the flood is equally grotesque. Far back, when the volcano now on Tanna was part of Aniwa, the rain fell and fell from day to day, and the sea rose till it threatened to cover everything. All were drowned, except the few who climbed up on the volcano mountain. The sea had already put out the volcano at the southern end of Aniwa, and Machikchiki, who dwelt in the greater volcano, becoming afraid of the extinction of his big fire too, split it off from Aniwa with all the land on the southeastern side and sailed it across to Tanna on the top of the flood. There, by his mighty strength, he heaved the volcano to the top of a high mountain in Tanna, where it remains to this day. For on the subsiding of the sea, he was unable to transfer his big fire to Aniwa, and so it was reduced to a very small island, without a volcano, and without a river, for the sins of the people long ago. Even where there are no snakes, they apply the superstitions about the serpent to a large, black, poisonous lizard called Kekvau. They call it Tiapolo, and women or children scream wildly at the sight of one. One of the darkest and most hideous blots on heathenism is the practice of infanticide. Only 3 cases came to our knowledge on Aniwa, but we publicly denounced them at all hazards and awoke not only natural feeling but the selfish interests of the community for the protection of the children. These 3 were the last that died there by parents' hands. A young husband, who had been jealous of his wife, buried their male child alive as soon as born. An old Tana woman, who had no children living, having at last a fine, healthy boy born to her, threw him into the sea before anyone could interfere to save. And a savage, in anger with his wife, snatched her baby from her arms, hid himself in the bush till night, and returned without the child, refusing to give any explanation except that he was dead and buried. Praise be to God, these 3 murderers of their own children were by and by touched with the story of Jesus, became members of the church, and each adopted little orphan children, towards whom they continued to show the most tender affection and care. Wife murder was also considered quite legitimate. In one of our inland villages dwelt a young couple, happy in every respect except they had had no children. The man, being a heathen, resolved to take home another wife, a widow with 2 children. This was naturally opposed by his young wife, and without the slightest warning, while she sat plaiting a basket, he discharged a ball into her from his loaded musket. It crashed through her arm and lodged in her side. Everything was done that was in my power to save her life, but on the 10th day tetanus came on, and she soon after passed away. The man appeared very attentive to her all the time, but being a heathen, he insisted that she had no right to oppose his wishes. He was not in any way punished or disrespected by the people of his village, but went out and in amongst them as usual, and took home the other woman as his wife a few weeks thereafter. His second wife began to attend church and school regularly with her children, and at last he also came along with them, changing very manifestly from his sullen and savage former self. They have a large family. They are avowedly trying to train them all for the Lord Jesus, and they take their places meekly at the Lord's table. It would give a wonderful shock, I suppose, to many namby-pamby Christians to whom the title Mighty to Save conveys no ideas of reality, to be told that 9 or 10 converted murderers were partaking with them the Holy Communion of Jesus. But the Lord, who reads the heart and weighs every motive and circumstance, has perhaps much more reason to be shocked by the presence of some of themselves. Penitence opens all the heart of God. Today, he said, thou shalt be with me in paradise. Chapter 64, Nell Wang's Elopement. Some most absurd and preposterous experiences were forced upon us by the habits and notions of the people. Amongst these, I recall very vividly the story of Nell Wang's elopement with his bride. I had begun in spare hours to lay the foundation of 2 additional rooms for our house and felt rather uneasy to see a well-known savage hanging around every day with his tomahawk and eagerly watching me at work. He had killed a man before our arrival on Aniwa and had also startled my wife by suddenly appearing from amongst the boxes and causing her to run for life. On seeing him hovering so alarmingly near, tomahawk in hand, I saluted him. Nell Wang, do you want to speak to me? Yes, missy, he replied. If you will help me now, I will be your friend forever. I answered, I am your friend. That brought me here and keeps me here. Yes, he said earnestly, but I want you to be strong as my friend, and I will be strong for you. I replied, "Well, how can I help you?" "I want to get married, and I need your help." I protested, "No, Wang, you know that marriages here are all made in infancy by children being bought and betrothed to their future husbands. How can I interfere? You don't want to bring evil on me and my wife and child. It might cost us our lives." "No, no, Missy. No one hears of this or can hear. Only help me now. You tell me, if you were my circumstances, how would you act?" "Well, that's surely very simple," I said. "Every man knows how to go about that business, if he wants to be honest. Look out for your intended. Find out if she loves you. The rest will follow, naturally. You will marry her." "Yes, but just there my trouble comes in." "Do you know the woman you would like to get?" I asked, wishing to bring him to some closer issue. "Yes, I want to marry Yakin, the chief's widow, up at the inland village, and that will break no infant betrothals." "But," I persevered, "do you know if she loves you or would take you?" "Yes. One day I met her on the path and told her I would like to have her for my wife. She took out her earrings and gave them to me, and I know thereby that she loves me. I was one of her late husband's men, and if she had loved any of them more than she loved me, she would have given them to another. With the earrings, she gave me her heart." "Well, then why," I insisted, "don't you go and marry her?" "There begins my difficulty. In her village there are 30 young men for whom there are no wives. Each of them wants her, but no one has the courage to take her, for the other 29 will shoot him." "And if you take her, the disappointed 30 will shoot you." "That's exactly what I see, Missy. But I want you just to think you are in my place and tell me how you would carry her off. You white men, you can always succeed. Missy, hear my plans. Advise me." With as serious a face as I could command, I had to listen to Nell Wong, to enter into his love affair, and to make suggestions with a view to avoiding bloodshed and other miseries. The result of the deliberations was that Nell Wong was to secure the confidence of two friends, his brother and the orator Taya, to place one at each end of the coral rocks above the village as watchman, to cut down with his American tomahawk a passage through the fence at the back, and to carry off his bride at dead of night into the seclusion and safety of the bush. Nell Wong's eyes flashed as he flourished his tomahawk about and cried, "I see it now, Missy. I shall win her from them all. Yakin and I will be strong for you all our days." Well, next morning, Yakin's house was found deserted. They sent to all the villages around, but no one had seen her. The hole in the fence behind was then discovered, and the 30 whispered to each other that Yakin had been wooed and won by some daring lover. Messengers were dispatched to all the villages, and Nell Wong was found to have disappeared on the same night as the widow, and neither could anywhere be found. The usual revenge was taken, the houses of the offenders burned, their fences broken down, and all their property either destroyed or distributed. Work was suspended, and the disappointed 30 solaced themselves by feasting at Yakin's expense. 3 weeks passed. The runaways were nowhere to be found. It was generally believed that they had gone in a canoe to Tana or Eromanga. But one morning, as I began my work at my house alone, the brave Nell Wong appeared at my side. "Hello," I said, "where have you come from, and where is Yakin?" "I must not tell you yet. We are hid. We have lived on coconuts gathered at night. Yakin is well and happy. I come now to fulfill my promise. I will help you, and Yakin will help Missy Peyton, the woman, and we shall be your friends. I have ground to be built upon and fenced, whenever we dare, but we will come and live with you until peace is secured. Will you let us come tomorrow morning?" All right, I said, "come tomorrow," and trembling with delight, he disappeared into the bush. Thus, strangely, God provided us with wonderful assistance. Yakin soon learned to wash and dress and clean everything, and Nel Wang served me like a faithful disciple. They clung by us like our very shadow, partly through fear of attack, partly from affection. But as each of them could handle freely both musket and tomahawk, which, though laid aside, were never far away, it was not every enemy that cared to try issues with Nel Wang and his bride. After a few weeks had thus passed by, and as both of them were really showing an interest in things pertaining to Jesus and his gospel, I urged them strongly to appear publicly at the church on Sabbath, to show that they were determined to stand their ground together as true husband and wife, and that the others must accept the position and become reconciled. Delay now could gain no purpose, and I wished the strife and uncertainty to be put to an end. Nel Wang knew our customs. Every worshipper has to be seated when our church bell ceases ringing. Anyones would be ashamed to enter after the service had actually begun. As the bell ceased, Nel Wang, knowing that he would have a clear course, marched in, dressed in shirt and kilt, but grasping very determinedly his tomahawk. He sat down as near to me as he could conveniently get, trying hard to conceal his manifest agitation. Silently smiling towards me, he then turned and looked eagerly at the other door through which the women entered and left the church, as if to say, "Yakin is coming." But his tomahawk was poised ominously on his shoulder, and his courage gave him a defiant and almost impudent air. He was evidently quite ready to sell his life at a high price if anyone was prepared to risk the consequences. In a few seconds, Yakin entered, and if Nel Wang's bearing and appearance were rather inconsistent with the feeling of worship, what on earth was I to do when the figure and costume of Yakin began to reveal itself marching in? The first visible difference betwixt a heathen and a Christian is that the Christian wears some clothing. The heathen wears none. Yakin had determined to show the extent of her Christianity by the amount of clothing she could carry upon her person. Being a chief's widow before she became Nel Wang's bride, she had some idea of state occasions, and appeared dressed in every article of European apparel, mostly portions of male attire, that she could beg or borrow from about the premises. Her bridal gown was a man's drab-colored greatcoat, put on above her native grass skirts and sweeping down to her heels, buttoned tight. Over this she had hung on a vest, and above that again, most amazing of all, she had superinduced a pair of men's trousers, planting the body of them on her neck and shoulders, and leaving her head and face looking out from between the legs, a leg from either side, streaming over her bosom, arid dangling down absurdly in front. Fastened to the one shoulder also, there was a red shirt, and to the other a striped shirt, waving about her like wings as she sailed along. Around her head a red shirt had been twisted like a turban, and her notions of art demanded that a sleeve thereof should hang aloft over each of her ears. She seemed to be a moving monster, loaded with a mass of rags. The day was excessively hot, and the perspiration poured over her face in streams. She, too, sat as near to me as she could get on the women's side of the church. Nel Wang looked at me and then at her, smiling quietly as if to say, "You never saw in all your white world a bride so grandly dressed." I little thought what I was bringing on myself when I urged them to come to church. The sight of that poor creature sweltering before me constrained me for once to make the service very short, and perhaps the shortest I ever conducted in all my life. The day ended in peace. The two souls were extremely happy, and I praised God that what might have been a scene of bloodshed had closed thus, even though it were in a kind of wild grotesquerie. Oh my, oh my. Next time, chapter 65, The Christ Spirit at Work. Amen. Thanks for listening. I do like hearing from you. Contact me, will you, with questions, comments. Just say hello at bob.j.faulkner.72@gmail.com. Do look around the site and find other things that might help you. There are readings from great preachers, stories from the persecuted church, Bible studies, and more. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun, and Lord willing, we'll talk again real soon. Bye-bye.